Good morning to all of you. Good morning, Dobrianik. On behalf of all of you, I wish to thank our vocal soloist for the beautiful, beautiful special music. We are blessed with a remarkable music program here in Kelowna, and more to come in the balance of the feast. If God should go on strike, how good it is that God above has never gone on strike, because he was not treated fair in things he didn't like. If only once he'd given up and said, "That's it, I'm through, I've had enough of those on earth, so this is what I'll do. I'll give my orders to the sun, cut off the heat supply, and to the moon, give no more light, and run the oceans dry, and just to make things really tough and put the pressure on, turn off the vital oxygen till every breath is gone." You know, he would be justified if fairness was the game, for no one has been more abused or met with more disdain than God. And yet he carries on supplying you and me with all the favors of his grace and everything for free. Men say they want a better deal, and so on strike they go. But what a deal we've given God, to whom all things we owe. We don't care whom we hurt to gain the things we like, but what a mess we'd all be in if God should go on strike. Today is Thanksgiving Day here in Canada, as you no doubt are keenly aware. It's been set aside as a day of giving of thanks nationally, coast to coast. And I wonder how many people today are making a very, very concerted effort to express formal thanks. We have no school today, no work today, by and large, although there are vital professions that are on duty today, but by and large, most people are off work and not in school. And I would imagine that many, many people are having turkey for dinner today, and we'll be enjoying pumpkin pie for dessert today. Probably won't be watching a whole lot of football today, but that comes in November. Nevertheless, the question that remains is, who are people expressing their thanks to? When thanks are being expressed on Thanksgiving Day, and hopefully they are, to whom are thanks being expressed to, is what I wonder most of all. Perhaps you do too with me. Open your Bible with me now, please, to Deuteronomy chapter 16 for a preliminary passage. Deuteronomy chapter 16. And let's start reading in verse 13. Where the Word of God says in Deuteronomy chapter 16, and let's start in verse 13, "You shall observe the Feast of Tabernacles 7 days." Now, the Feast of Tabernacles, which we are observing now together here in Kelowna, and other brethren are at various other sites across Canada and throughout the United States and around the world, is also called, it's not just called the Feast of Tabernacles, although that's primarily how we identify the feast and understand the feast, but it is also called the Feast of Ingathering. We also have that term for it. Why? Well, the verse explains. "You shall observe the Feast of Tabernacles 7 days, when you've gathered from your threshing floor and from your winepress." It's called the Feast of Ingathering as well as the Feast of Tabernacles because it's harvest time. This is the time of year when people do their harvesting. And that big, gorgeous, beautiful full moon, did you see it last night? It's almost full. It's a waning moon now, no longer a waxing moon. But it's a harvest moon this time of year. It's big and beautiful, low on the horizon, perfect for working into the evening and into the night by for people who farm. So you gather from the threshing floor and your wine press, and you shall rejoice, it says, in your feast. It's wonderful for God to command us to be happy, to be jubilant, to be celebratory, and we have been, by and large, as God's people. You shall rejoice in your feast, you and your son and your daughter, your male servant, your female servant, the Levite, the stranger, the fatherless, and the widow who are within your gates. So it's indicating here that there should be a family atmosphere at each feast site, and that everyone should be included, and that no one should be forgotten or excluded or somehow sidelined. And it goes on to tell us in verse 15, 7 days you shall keep a sacred feast, or solemn feast, as it has in the original King James, to the Lord your God, not to one another, not even to the church or to ourselves, But we're making an appearance here before God. 7 days you shall keep a sacred feast to the Lord your God in the place which the Lord chooses. And for us this year, that place is Kelowna, British Columbia, Canada, North America, Earth, Milky Way. And we're delighted to be here in this beautiful, beautiful vacation destination. In which the place which the Lord your God chooses, why? One of the reasons we keep the feast, and there is a multiple number of reasons, but notice here, why do we keep the feast here or anywhere wherever God's people are gathered? Because the Lord your God will bless you. And it gives two categories of blessings, or two definitions, or two ways of categorizing. God will bless you in all your produce and in all the work of your hands. So this passage shows fairly clearly, I believe, that one of the reasons why we're here to keep the Feast of Tabernacles is to celebrate and to acknowledge God's bountiful blessings. This day is Thanksgiving Day, but really each and once in a while, Thanksgiving Day is during the Feast of Tabernacles. Not every year, but once in a while in Canada, it falls always on a Monday. Sometimes it's during the feast. But really, the Feast of Tabernacles every year is a kind of Thanksgiving week. And you remember in years past, different feast sites where some of the decorations at the feast have a Thanksgiving motif, where there's a cornucopia, and there's fruit and vegetables spilling out of the cornucopia, which gives us even a visual connection to the Feast of Tabernacles being like a Thanksgiving week. And the latter part of the verse says, so that you shall surely rejoice. Verse 14 simply says, you shall rejoice. The latter part of verse 15 says, you shall surely rejoice. So it sounds like God really wants us to be happy, you know, to be jubilant, to be appreciative of his blessings and his bounty. So what we'll look at today in today's sermon is appreciation. Let's evaluate our capacity and our capability for thankfulness. Not just during the feast, but especially during the feast, and then beyond that all year round. Do you remember reading in church literature and perhaps elsewhere how the Thanksgiving Day celebration that we have here in Canada and in the United States probably, historically, has its roots in the Feast of Tabernacles? According to David Stern from the Jewish New Testament commentary, he says, and I quote, the festival also celebrates the harvest, coming as it does at summer's end, so that it is a time of thanksgiving. David Stern adds in the same source, Jewish New Testament Commentary, page 175, commenting on John 7:2, the Puritans, who took the Old Testament more seriously than most Christians, modeled the American holiday of thanksgiving after Sukkot, or Sukkoth, or the Feast of Booths. And so you remember that they had 3 days in which they invited their neighbors, and some historical sources say the festival they kept for Thanksgiving lasted a week back then. And so that's where the roots of Thanksgiving really go to the pilgrims, beyond that to the Feast of Tabernacles itself. Now we find ourselves, though, just by virtue of being human, that after a while we simply grow dull and mechanical, that we're worn just by living. It just wears us down after a while, and I'll explain more as we go along. Exodus 13, please. Exodus 13. And let's look at the last couple of verses in this chapter. Last three verses, in fact. So they, the Israelites, took their journey from Succoth, and camped in Etham at the edge of the wilderness. It's describing ancient Israel making their exit out of Egypt. And they were all packed and probably were just as excited and filled with anticipation as you were last week when you were getting everything together and going through your checklist and heading out for Kelowna for the feast. And there's so much anticipation and so many things you look forward to and so many things you're planning to accomplish and people you're planning to see. And there's an excitement on opening night, opening day, the first part of the feast. And as the feast goes on, the excitement is still there, but it diminishes because we get tireder and tireder and we're running out of steam. And eventually we run out of money too at the end of the feast, as we should, because we are spending our festival tithe as directed to. Next verse. And the Lord went before them by day in a pillar of cloud to lead the way, and by night in a pillar of fire to give them light, so as to go by day and by night. What an awesome, awesome sight that must have been to see this pillar of cloud during the day and a pillar of fire during the night. And it turned into fire at night, back to a cloud during the day, back to a pillar of fire at night, just like a street lamp automatically going off and on. What a stupendous sight that was. And the next verse says, and he did not take away the pillar of cloud by day or the pillar of fire by night from before the people. And these pillars were visible symbols of God's presence. And they were their constant guide and their constant accompaniment and constant companion. How long, we wonder, did it take before the Israelites took those pillars for granted? To when a Gentile would come up and say, what's that? And the Israelite would say, what's what? That pillar. Oh, that. That's just a pillar of cloud. That's God. That's a pillar of fire. That's God. Do you have pillars of cloud and pillars of fire in your life that indicate to you God's guidance in your life, His direction in your life? What are the pillars of cloud and pillars of fire that you've experienced this past year or in the last few years or even this week? I think back, frankly, to the founding of the United Church of God itself as a significant pillar to me, how it came to be, how it was established, the beginning of ABC, Beyond Today Television, and what all of that entails. It's amazing. It's astonishing. If you go back to the first transmission of the Morse code, do you remember what the first word or words were when the Morse code was transmitted? What hath God wrought? Indicating that the developer of that message, that means of communication, realized there was something miraculous there. Now we take instant communication for granted, probably invented so that the gospel could be preached. But what is a pillar of cloud in your life or a pillar of fire in your life? How about each Feast of Tabernacles? How about each service at each Feast of Tabernacles? From the opening prayer through to the closing prayer and everything in between, how astonishing and inspiring that is. Inspiration real to you? We hear prayers each day, opening prayers, concluding prayers, and a petition is made to inspire the speaking and inspire the listening. And those people who are on the docket that day, they say amen to those prayers with extra enthusiasm and conviction. But I find, for instance, if there is a tape to be played in a local church area or a DVD, and in order to be sure there's no technical problem, I'll preview it the Friday evening before and find at home a DVD from Cincinnati, from Mr. Kyla, for instance, is of interest and value and meaningful. And I play it at home on a Friday evening to be sure it's technically not flawed. The next day, play it at church, and guess what? There's much more meaning and inspiration the next day at church than there was at home the night before. How come? God's people are there. I think the rheostat has turned up a little bit more, and God provides extra inspiration because it works on the speaking level and on the listening level as well. James chapter 4, let's turn there next. Ingratitude. Do you suffer from ingratitude? We all do, and we're trying not to. And what about the rest of society? Well, ingratitude is not like unfaithfulness or greed or lying or stealing. Something attracts people to all of those, but what attracts people to ingratitude? That's just it. Nothing. Ingratitude has no attraction. How does it occur? Why does it occur? James chapter 4, verse 17. Therefore, last verse of chapter 4 in James, therefore, to him who knows to do good and does not do it, to him it is sin. What does this verse tell us? What does this verse teach us? Well, that there are two kinds of sin, or two classifications for sin. First of all, sins of commission That's where you and I may do something wrong actively. And on the other hand, there are sins of omission where we don't do what we should do. So sins of commission are like breaking the Ten Commandments, lying, stealing, murdering, committing adultery, etc. Sins of omission, an example of that is ingratitude. Apparently, there are some jurisdictions where it is it breaks the law to not be a good Samaritan. So where if you happen to be in a vicinity and you see someone's in trouble, they've had an accident, they've been injured, they've been attacked, and if you neglect them, and you walk right on by and don't offer them any help, and then you're apprehended, you can be charged for breaking the law. And you would say to the peace officer, but I didn't do anything wrong. Well, yes, you did. You didn't do something that you could have done or should have done. That would then be the charge under those circumstances, a sin of omission as opposed to a sin of commission. Do you remember the comedy movie Cool Runnings? John Candy is in it. Wonderful Canadian actor. Yes, a Canadian actor. Too bad he's not around anymore. John Candy is in that picture. It's about the first Jamaican bobsled team to go to the Olympics. And John Candy plays a former American gold medalist who becomes a coach to the Jamaican team. The players grow to really admire this American coach, and they affectionately eventually dub him Sled God. And remember, because there's not a lot of snow in Jamaica, not a lot of mountains in Jamaica, they were training in the bathtub and making the most of it and put together a fairly reasonably competent team. But as they were preparing, if you hearken back to Cool Runnings later in the story, the coaches shady history comes out. In an Olympics following his gold medal performance, he broke the rules by weighting the U.S. sled and then being disgraced because he was found out, he and the team. And one of the Jamaican bobsledders couldn't understand why anyone who had already won a gold medal would cheat. And finally, he nervously asked Candy to explain, and John Candy, in the role of the coach, said, I had to win, but I learned something. If you are not happy without a gold medal, you won't be happy with it either. A very important lesson. Now, in today's Globe and Mail, on the back page of Section 1, there's a whole page devoted to Thanksgiving. Thanksgiving, you will have noticed, you are our American cousins, is not billed as highly in Canada as it is in the U.S. In the U.S., Thanksgiving Day is much more emphasized, much more promoted. Not so here in Canada. Should be, could be, but regrettably, it isn't. Job chapter 38. But it can be in the church, and it should be at the Feast of Tabernacles. Job chapter 38. Does God ever get tired of his creation? Do you think? Does he ever think, I'm just tired. I think it's time to remodel the universe. Some people get tired of the decor in their homes. There's nothing wrong with the furniture, nothing wrong with the wallpaper, nothing wrong with the drapes. You just, after a while, you get tired. You want to get rid of it all and then redecorate. Does God ever get tired of his creation? Do you think? Job chapter 38 is a chapter that, and on into chapter 39, God uses the arguments here or the discussion here, and he challenges Job by describing the beauty and complexity of planet Earth, which beauty and complexity was referred to and mentioned in some of the hymns we sang this morning. Chapter 38, verse 1, the Lord answered Job out of the whirlwind and said, who is this who darkens counsel by words without knowledge? God challenging Job, who was on his high horse at this time, as you'll remember. Now prepare yourself like a man, and I will question you, God said to Job, as if you were being cross-examined in a court of law, and you will answer me. Where were you when I laid the foundations of the earth? Tell me if you have understanding. Who determined its measurements? Surely you know. Or who stretched the line upon it? To what were its foundations fastened? Or who laid its cornerstone, referring to the beginning of planet Earth as if it were a gigantic construction project? And then verse 7, when the morning stars sang together and all the sons of God shouted for joy, describing how the angelic host watched planet Earth being created put together and its contents added. They were enthusiastic, these awesome angels, as we heard in the sermonette not too long ago. You can read the rest of the chapter for yourself. I just want to refer to verse 22, and then I would urge you, if you have time, or when you have time, to read chapter 38 in its fullness, and then chapter 39. Verse 22, have you entered the treasury of snow? Have you ever seen the treasury of hail, which I've reserved for the time of trouble, for the battle of war, or for the day of battle and war, pardon me? By what way is light diffused, or the east wind scattered over the earth? Have you entered the treasury of snow? The motif for this year's dance, many of you were there last night, was winter, winter wonderland, and there were beautiful decorations of snowflakes and other artifacts or indicators of the coming winter. Is it really true that no two snowflakes are alike? Now, we don't look forward to snow, particularly as we get older. If we're still younger, we may still look forward to snow, but those of us who live in snowy climates don't get as enthusiastic about that first snowfall. But when you go for a walk and you see some of the snowflakes land on your sleeve or on your mitt and you look at them, isn't every snowflake a hexagon? It's a crystal. Each one is a crystal, and you think of how many, in a typical average snowfall, how many snowflakes would fall? 100? 1,000? A million? There have been, how do they know that no two snowflakes are alike? If evolution were true, most of them would be alike, I think. But no two snowflakes are alike because there have been photographers in the primitive days of photography, when it was still being developed, who found a way, one in particular, a Canadian, I believe, in Nova Scotia, if I'm not mistaken, who found a way to capture snowflakes. And he photographed dozens, hundreds, thousands. Can you imagine doing this? This 10,001 snap, 10,002 snap, and all of these snowflakes are crystalline hexagons, if I'm not mistaken, each one different. That's a remarkable creative power that our Creator in heaven above supplies. Why is the sky blue? If you look at Job 38, 39, referring to the universe, to planet Earth, why is the sky blue? Why is grass green? And isn't green a wonderful color? Don't you love it? And if you look around presently, how many shades of green are there? If you go 17 miles up, the sky is always black. But after it's rained for a while, as it did recently here, and the next morning you get up and you see the sky is going to be clear and the sun comes up over the horizon and it bathes the landscape with its sunlight, and the greens come out and the vivid blues emerge, and you think, oh, it's going to be a glorious, gorgeous day, as it has been for the last few days. Why is the sky blue? Because of the dust in the atmosphere that diffuses the light. And if there were no dust, there would never be any droplets of water or snowflakes either, or clouds or fog. You have to have that in order for moisture to condense and form around dust. So next time you dust your living room, you think, oh, why does it have to be dust? Be thankful for that dust, because without it, the sky wouldn't be blue, and it wouldn't rain, and you wouldn't have fog or snow. Does God ever get tired of the creation? I don't think so. Every time the sun comes up, I can imagine God saying to himself, that's simply beautiful. That's gorgeous. I never get tired of it. Every time a daisy pushes through the topsoil, I can imagine God saying to himself, that's beautiful. That's gorgeous. I never tire of it. Every time a robin sings, I can imagine God saying, that's beautiful. That's gorgeous. Have you ever heard a robin sing off key? They all have perfect pitch. They all sing so beautifully. Some of us sing really well. Some of us are excellent singers. Some of us are average. Some of us don't sing too well at all. Someone said I've been disquiershipped once, a theological term that I picked up some years ago from those who might even be here with us today. But we get tired of things so quickly just because of living. We grow dull, we grow mechanical, we're worn by the living, we fall into boredom too easily, into routine too easily. They say the only difference between the grave and a rut is its depth. And So we find ourselves, we get into a rut, we get into a routine, and coming to the Feast of Tabernacles breaks us out of it. We have a change of scenery, a change of pace, a change of venue, all these people we spend time with. We're taught, we're instructed, as we heard in today's opening prayer. We are motivated through not only services, by spending time together before services, after services, and at all of these activities, breaks us out of that rut. Act 17. We have lost the art of appreciation by virtue of being human. And as Christians, practicing Christians, we're trying to be appreciative, by and large. But we need to somehow, some way, recapture the art of appreciation, so that simple things don't seem too simple. But in today's society, simple things seem too simple. And the average citizen, it seems, is after the novel. That is, the unusual, the new. 1,000 video games. If I had them, then I'd be happy, some people think. 1,000 video games may offer newness and excitement, but only for a while, because they too grow old and become commonplace. New things soon grow old and need replacing. That's just the way it is. Act 17, and we'll just read verse 21. For all the Athenians and the foreigners who were there spent their time in nothing else but either to tell or to hear some new thing. They were after something new, something unusual, something with a twist. That was them then. We tend to be a little bit like that, maybe a lot of bit like that, in North America, Western Europe, Australia, New Zealand, etc. People take mind-altering drugs. Why? They take mind-altering drugs as though they think their natural minds have somehow gone flat, like Pepsi sitting in a glass overnight on the counter. Taste it in the morning. Flat, doesn't taste good anymore. Or are there individuals who think that flashing strobe lights are more remarkable than a sunrise or a sunset or a lightning and thunder storm? Kelowna is a vacationer's paradise. Just a fabulous place for boating and water skiing and skidooing and parasailing and dirt biking and in the wintertime skiing, snowboarding, snowmobiling. And back to the summer, sky jumping, bungee jumping. But what about tiddlywinks? What about checkers? What about Chinese ladders? Have you seen little kids who've been given so many gifts, so many presents? After a while, they tire and they play with the boxes that the presents came in. You think, I paid a lot of money for all those gifts. And the child is forgetting about the stuff that came in the boxes, but they're piling the boxes around because there's more imagination involved there. I'm thinking of a couple who remarked, because they had the means to do so, regarding their vacation, that last year for their vacation they'd gone on a trip around the world, and next year they were going to go somewhere else. How do you do that? We've lost the art of appreciation. We grow weary, worn just by the living. And this quest for newness affects us as well. We're not immune, especially when we live in a society that is being schooled and programmed to be consuming more and more and more and to be dissatisfied. How big is your TV? It's only 42-inch? Ha! Huh. You can't be happy with a 42-inch TV. You need to have a 57 or a 61 or 108 pretty soon. You have to have a huge house just for the screen. We'll have to move into theaters, I suppose, in order to accommodate what will be built yet to come. James chapter 1. The quest for newness affects us too. When's the last time we marveled, that you marveled, at God's basic spiritual gifts? What kind of basic spiritual gifts? Well, look at James chapter 1 with me, verse 16 through 17. Do not be deceived, my beloved brethren. Every good gift and every perfect gift is from above and comes down from the Father of lights. What a beautiful description of our Creator. The Father of lights. And look at the lighting on the stage here today, as there has been each day, and how meaningful it is. Every good, every perfect gift is from above and comes down from the Father of lights, with whom there is no variation or shadow of turning. Yes, the gifts we enjoy day by day, week by week, month by month, year by year, those gifts come from God, and the best gifts are from Him and are free. When's the last time you marveled at your ability to be able to read the Word of God, where you have a copy of the Bible, multiple copies of the Bible, and every morning or noonday or evening you can open up the Bible at your leisure, even at work, if nobody's watching, or depending on what your situation is, if somebody is watching, and actually read the Word of God. Did you read the article in the paper a few days ago about the individual who learned to read at age 93? He finally had an opportunity at age 93 to learn how to read, and what a phenomenal experience it was. How phenomenal is another gift that you and I have, and that is the privilege, the honor, the opportunity, in fact, the responsibility to pray. When you go down on your knees to pray this morning, or maybe you prayed in bed because it was too cold to get out for a little while and you finally shifted to your knees. But when you talk to God this morning in prayer, personal prayer, how awesome and phenomenal was that? That is, you know, because I don't have an opportunity very often to phone up President Bush or Prime Minister Harper and ask them for some help. But I can talk to God the Father every day. And so can you. It's a phenomenal opportunity. Whenever I call them up, I never get a busy schedule. I never get put on hold. And I'm never told, now, if you're having concerns about health, press 1. If you're having concerns about finances, press 2. Never get that. Isn't prayer phenomenal that you have an opportunity to get through to God the Father directly through Jesus Christ? Prayer is phenomenal. It's a gift. It's a wonderful opportunity. How astonishing is God's plan to you? We have greater insights at the Feast of Tabernacles, and we have opportunity here to realize that God's way of life and God's truth and God's plan is phenomenal. But by virtue of being human, we begin to take even His way of life and His truths for granted. And we have to fight it. We have to resist it. We have to look for ways to get around that proclivity which we are all subjected to. As others have mentioned recently, I too, along with my wife and others of you who are here, have become a grandparent. And I don't know how that happened, but it did. And I marvel at things that I used to observe others marveling at and wonder what's wrong with them. And now I understand. We were told by those who are grandparents, wait till you have your first grandchild, you will go through something phenomenal. And I said, sure, we'll see what happens. And sure enough, it does happen that way. I remember when my dad would come and visit my wife and myself and our children when they were little. My dad was not a good father in the sense he did not know how to father properly. He did the best he could. But he was a far better grandfather than he was a dad to me. And one thing I saw him do sometimes, is he would come into our daughter's room when she was little and simply put a chair by her bed and wait for her to wake up. He'd sit, put the chair by the bed and simply wait for a half hour or so watching her sleep until she woke up, and then he would spend time with her. Now I understand and appreciate that. In eulogizing Jim Henson, remember Jim Henson, creator of the Muppet characters on Sesame Street, and then beyond that, the Muppet movie, and even mentioned Saskatchewan in that. Do you remember? It rhymed with something. That's not easy to do. In eulogizing Jim Henson, creator of the Muppet characters on Sesame Street, his longtime friend and co-worker Frank Oz. If you've seen the bylines on Sesame Street, you'll remember Frank Oz as a name. He was a co-producer and one of the voices. I'm not sure whether he was Oscar the Grouch or Ernie the Bert or Ernie and Bert or who he might have been the voice for. But Jim Henson died young, you'll remember. And at the funeral, Frank Oz eulogized him. And he said, I really don't believe that Jim could have been such an extraordinary creator. I really don't believe that Jim could have been such an extraordinary creator if he hadn't been such an extraordinary appreciator. That's quite a wonderful thing to say at someone's funeral, at a eulogy. He wouldn't have been such a terrific creator if he hadn't been an extraordinary appreciator. And we of all people, God's people, should be extraordinary appreciators. Hebrews 13, please. Hebrews 13, verse 5. What usually comes before covetousness? Now, we know covetousness is a sin. It's the Tenth Commandment. It spells it out, forbids it. What comes before covetousness? What often triggers covetousness? Well, I would propose that it's ungratefulness. Ungratefulness is often what triggers covetousness. Hebrews 13, verse 5. Let your conduct be without covetousness. Behave, live your life, Christians are told, without being covetous. But in today's materialistic society, in the Western world, we're schooled to be covetous. And we have to fight it. It isn't easy. Be content with such things as you have. Well, marketing says we shouldn't be. The Bible says otherwise. Let your conduct be without covetousness. Be content with such things as you have. For he himself has said, I will never leave you nor forsake you. Can you imagine, thinking back to yesterday's sermon, Adam, after being given Eve in the Garden of Eden, immediately complaining? Couldn't I have two wives? But I prefer a blonde. She's a brunette. Or if you were a blonde, I'd prefer a redhead. Can you imagine Adam complaining in that regard? Only a man who fails to appreciate the wonders of womanhood could think that his own wife isn't enough. And the only way a husband can covet another woman is by not appreciating the one God already gave to him. And we can switch that around. Did Eve say, but he doesn't have blue eyes, but he doesn't have blonde hair, or he's not tall enough? Dr. Laura wrote a column some time ago in which she addressed the topic of the Tenth Commandment. And she described two categories. And normally we think of nations, at least the way they are presented to us, as have nations and have not. Or people in society, whether it's Canada, United States, Europe, have and have not. And she identified, by quoting the Wall Street Journal, that there's another category, and that is the haves and the have-mores, referring to people who are near the top of the economic pyramid in their society. And they see others who make even more than they do, who have a bigger house, a bigger boat, a bigger bank account, a higher position, and because there's someone who is a little higher up the pyramid, even though they're pretty high up themselves, they are no longer happy. How can that be? So she says, as the article concludes, we can rise above these baser instincts to focus on our blessings and be thankful for all that we do have. Gratitude is the best medicine for covetousness. That's true, isn't it? But why is it so hard to do? Why is it so difficult to practice? Why is it we think about what we don't have as opposed to what we do have? Because the more often we receive something, more regularly we receive it, the more we take it for granted. I don't get sick too often. I probably shouldn't have said that. Because that's the sure cause of the common cold. As you know, every winter, if you say, I haven't had a cold yet all winter, you're going to get one as soon as you say that, just because you said it. But whenever I do get sick, and I'm on the sick bed for a week or two, and I'm all moaning and groaning, you know how horrible husbands are as patients, I'm dying, help, help. Then after I get well, I say to God, sincerely, I will not take good health for granted again. I've been sick, I've learned my lesson, now I'll be grateful for my good health. And a few weeks go by, a few months go by, and I take my good health for granted. It's the human condition that we have to wrestle with in the human state we find ourselves in. Acts 14, we need to relearn the strength and beauty of the familiar. We need to relearn and recapture the strength And the beauty of the familiar, because truly the best things in life are free. That's in the back of our minds, but we need to somehow take them from the back of our minds and bring that concept, that realization, to the front of our minds. Acts 14, beautiful, beautiful passage here, starting in verse 15 of chapter 14. Men, why are you doing these things? We also are men with the same nature as you, and preach to you that you should turn from these useless things to the living God. A remarkable, distinctive title for our Creator, the living God who made the heaven, the earth, the sea, and all things that are in them, who in bygone generations allowed all nations to walk in their own ways. And then verse 17, and we'll stop reading there in this chapter for this point. Nevertheless, describing the way God has worked with planet Earth and the inhabitants of planet Earth, and with human beings in particular, nevertheless, he did not leave himself without witness. He did not leave himself without witness in that he did good, and he gave us rain from heaven and fruitful seasons, filling our hearts with food and gladness. What more could a person want? As you look at this delineation, rain, fruitful seasons, food, and gladness. That describes the feast experience in so many ways. And the world to come, even more so, as we've heard already. When winter comes and spring finally arrives, I really look forward to that first rainstorm, that first April shower, to hear the pitter-patter of rain hitting the window or the roof, first thunderstorm, the smell of ozone. Oh, it's just marvelous when that happens. We had rain on the opening night, and we had to cross a few puddles to get to our car, but still it refreshed the landscape. Beautiful rain, fruitful seasons. Look at this part of the world in which we live right now for a week. This is orchard country. This is the California of Canada, the Okanagan Valley. If you go down south along the Okanagan Valley to the U.S. border in the Osoyoos area and beyond, there actually is a natural desert area there where cacti grow. Cacti? Cactuses. They're not huge. They're not like Joshua trees. But they're little, and they're real cacti growing out in the barrens. So you can grow anything in this part of the world as long as you water it. If you can irrigate it, it will grow. The world tomorrow, I don't think that'll be necessary. But we have served in the coffee bar area some produce that some of you who are orchardists bring, and you have donated apples. And aren't those apples wonderful, organic apples, all? How many apples have you tried this week? Have you tried some of those apples, the bounty of the earth that it tells us here, fruitful seasons, all kinds of apples. Different. There used to be hundreds of varieties of apples. Now we have maybe a dozen that are available. And some of you have trees that you grow five or six varieties in one tree. That's the kind of tree I like. One tree, six varieties. You don't have to have an orchard, just one tree, and it produces this remarkable fruit. Food and gladness. Also exhilarating this time of year are the fall colors. Have you looked at the trees to see how they're turning yellow, gold, maybe crimson and purple? And you think, how does that happen? And why does it happen? Does a tree need to turn colors? Does one tree look at the other tree and say, Myrtle, you're looking great today. Or this year, I really like your coat this year. But if you research or read about it, the tree simply cuts off the flow of sap to the leaves. The chlorophyll in the leaf will eventually then turn yellow. And as it freezes, there are sugars and acids that will turn to further colors. The trees don't need this. The trees don't benefit from it. For whose benefit is it? For ours, as we see this remarkable time of year. And it's a bonus for human beings. I've not seen any dogs and cats gazing at the colors. What do you think of the foliage this year? No, I'm impressed. They're not noticing. I see ducks each morning swimming out in the water, going for breakfast, as ducks do, Mr. and Mrs. Duck, and they pair off. You see them. They're beautiful, but they're not admiring their surroundings at all. They're just looking for bugs or food or fishes or bread or some kind of handout. 1 Timothy chapter 6, please. We're the ones who have been given the capacity to appreciate, but that capacity has to be guarded and developed. Promoted. We have to be reminded of it. And that's what one of the reasons or one of the lessons of the Feast of Tabernacles. 1 Timothy, please. Chapter 6, Verse 17, command those who are rich in this present age not to be haughty, nor to trust in uncertain riches. But instead, all of us, regardless of economic status, are to trust in the living God. Same beautiful description or title of our Creator. In the living God, and notice, who gives us richly all things to enjoy. We're not supposed to be materialistic. We're not supposed to be, as this world would want us to be, just consumers with reckless abandon. But that doesn't mean we can't enjoy what God gives us. He still gives us things. Why? So we can enjoy them. He gives us things richly, not to tolerate, not to endure, to enjoy. To enjoy things. He has designed for certain enjoyments for His people. Remember, somebody used to say, it's not the thing, it's the use of the thing. That's the sin. So if we accept what God intended and we use it the way He intended it to be used, it's not a sin. We're to accept, acquire, and during the feast, we do. One of the things that's really interesting to observe during the feast is our feast gifts. Now, it's not a time of Christmas for us. You realize that. I realize that. But a feast gift. And when you receive one, or you give one to someone, or you give one to yourself, think of Mr. Bean. Remember Mr. Bean, who has a birthday party for himself and no one else has remembered him, and so he puts a little bag on the table and he gets a prize and he opens it and he has a surprise birthday party for himself. Mr. Bean does. And he goes through the antics extremely well, and he's convincing, in fact, with his acting skills. But a feast gift. Try to really appreciate and relish anything you buy, anything you acquire. Ladies, a new pair of shoes, some of you probably have today even. A new pair of shoes or another item of attire that you're wearing today or did yesterday or tomorrow, that's a feast gift. Men, maybe you have a new tie. And we're kind of shy about something new. I remember as a school kid hating to wear something new to school because kids will notice it and torment you for it. But here, and the little kids are very good at this. A child will walk up to you and say, I got new shoes, or I have new socks, and they'll even hoist their trousers up so you can see their new socks. What's wrong with that? So you can say to someone, I have a new feast tie. What do you think? Did I make a good choice? Sometimes you can say it twice. I have a new tie. Do you like it? God gives us richly all things to enjoy, especially during the feast, and especially as we share with one another. Psalm 103. Psalm 103. Too often, because of our human condition, we look in the wrong direction. At sunrise, we look west. Sure dark out there. And at sunset, we look east. Sure dark out there. We're missing so much just by looking in the wrong direction. Psalm 103, first couple of verses. Bless the Lord, O my soul. And all that is within me, bless His holy name. We sing these words or words like them in our hymnals and have through the years. Bless the Lord, O my soul, and all that is within me, bless His holy name. Bless the Lord, O my soul, verse 2, Psalm 103. Bless the Lord, O my soul, and forget not all His benefits. Why does it say remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy? Because we have a proclivity to forget. Why does it say, forget not all His benefits? Because we have a proclivity not to remember. We think of what we don't have as opposed to what we do have. Remember the hymn we used to sing, Count Your Blessings, Name Them One by One? I missed that hymn. Helen Keller said the following. Remember Helen Keller, who was blind and deaf, both blind and deaf from age 2. There have been books written about her in movies, particularly about the lady who taught her how to speak and how to read Braille. Helen Keller said, I have often thought that it would be a blessing if each human being were stricken blind and deaf for a few days at some time during their adult life. Darkness would make them appreciate sight, and silence would teach them the sounds of joy. I take my sight for granted. I take my hearing for granted, for the most part. my ability to walk for granted, for the most part. I had a broken leg once, broken ankle from playing hockey. I haven't played hockey since, or skated since, because my leg remained vertical and my ankle went horizontal. And as I watch hockey players now put on their brakes and the spray of ice goes on, I still wince. And so I was confined to crutches for 6 weeks. I went to a conference in Cincinnati in a wheelchair, and Mr. Saloma had a chance to push me. And so we were going through the airport, and I was saying, faster, faster. He was taking the corners way too fast, but on the straightaway, we could have used a little more speed. And I was quite concerned about what will happen, because Passover was coming up pretty soon. And as it turned out, my cast was removed on the morning of Passover. So that evening was Passover service. That morning the cast was removed, and I was actually able then to wash someone else's feet, both of them, and have my feet washed, both of them, without a cast. But we take things even like walking for granted. And then we think, I'll never take it for granted again, but chances are we do. Have you grown dull and mechanical by virtue of being human? Jesus didn't allow that to happen to him. Look at Luke chapter 7. Luke chapter 7. This is a remarkable occasion in his life that bears emphasis at this juncture of the sermon. Now, when he concluded all his sayings, Luke chapter 7, in the hearing of the people, he entered Capernaum. And a certain centurion servant who was dear to him was sick and ready to die. So there was a centurion who had a whole bunch of servants, but one servant in particular was sick, not just sick, but he was about to die, and he was one of his favorite servants, in fact. So when he heard about Jesus, the centurion sent elders of the Jews to him, pleading with him, with Jesus, to come and heal a servant, because somehow he knew that Jesus could. And when they came to Jesus, they begged him, the emissaries, earnestly, saying that the one for whom he should do this was deserving. He was not your ordinary centurion. For he loves our nation, and he's built us a synagogue, which proves the point. And then Jesus went with them, having been persuaded. And when he was already not far from the house, covered most of the distance, the centurion sent more friends to him, saying to him, Lord, do not trouble yourself, even though you're almost here, for I'm not worthy that you should enter under my roof. Can you imagine? A guest of honor nearly arrived at your home, and he's being dissuaded. Therefore, I did not even think myself worthy to come to you, but say the word, and my servant will be healed. For I also am a man placed under authority, having soldiers under me. And I say to one, go, he goes, to another, come, and he comes, to my servant, do this, and he does it. And when Jesus heard these things, he marveled at him, not even having met him. And turned around and said to the crowd that followed him, I say to you, I have not found such great faith, not even in Israel. What was his reaction? Did he just take it in stride? Not bat an eyelash? The scripture says he marveled. This connotes admiration and wonder, that he was really, really impressed by what happened, by what was done, by what was said. Jesus did not say, I'm the Son of God. I must be cool, calm, and collected at all times. I must be composed and reserved. I must stay cool. Don't be impressed. He marveled. He had the capacity, even as the Son of God, to marvel. And so should you. And so should I. To where we marvel a little more than we ordinarily do. There are marvelous things that happen in our lives. And there are certainly a lot of marvelous things that happen during the feast, that have happened, that will happen. 100th psalm, please. Next, turn to the 100th psalm. This is called a thanksgiving psalm. Psalm 100, or the 100th psalm. A psalm of thanksgiving. A very beautiful passage. Make a joyful shout to the Lord, all you lands. Serve the Lord with gladness. Come before his presence with singing. We have done that at each and every service. We'll do that as we conclude today. We'll do it again tomorrow. Knowing that the Lord, he is God. It is he who made us, and not we ourselves. For we are his people and the sheep of his pasture. And verse 4 to me describes what we do when we observe the Feast of Tabernacles year after year. Enter into his gates During the feast, we enter into God's gates. We have a foretaste of the world tomorrow. We have instruction for the world today. Enter into His gates. How should we do it? With thanksgiving. Enter into His gates with thanksgiving and into His courts with praise. Be thankful to Him and bless His name. For the Lord is good, His mercy is everlasting, and His truth endures to all generations. The Feast of Tabernacles is, in a very real sense, a kind of Thanksgiving week. And we of all people on the face of the earth have the most to be thankful for, not only for the now, but for what is yet to come. A most fitting and appropriate prayer is this, especially this time of year, something along the lines of the following, that you and I can pray this week, later today perhaps. Father in heaven, you've given so much to me, so very, very much. Please give me just one more thing, a grateful and an appreciative heart. And He will.